Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It would be a Wolves fan, eh?
On goes Paul. People might yet win it here for Wolves. Blasting the shot. What a goal!
Hello and welcome everyone to today's episode of Wolves Fancast. Rich Hobbs here to talk about all things Wolves versus West Ham. It was all going so well in the first half and then it dropped off a cliff before having a quite explosive ending to the game. We will obviously be talking about VAR, subjective offsides and all the rest of it. But joining me on this merry adventure this evening or morning or afternoon, whenever you listen to your podcast, I've got Jafo joining me.
Evening, guys. Evening, guys.
And over from America, we've got Paul Lappage from the Whole Lot of Wolves podcast. Paul, how's it going?
It is going good. Howdy, everyone.
I can imagine you're somewhat a bit tired after the last couple of days because you're based in Houston and you're over in Nashville.
That's right. Game. It was the Premier League mornings live fan fest in Nashville. So I reckon it was probably 3,000 fans there in total yesterday, probably similar today. A big collection of those fans for the games that are watching. Big screens, enclosed area, right at the end of Broadway in Nashville, which is like the strip. So if anyone hasn't been, Nashville is like a combination of Las Vegas and Blackpool, but without the beach. So it had all of that going for it. And then right at the bottom, there was this complex where they put the screens up and you had to queue ages to get any type of food or drink. And the toilets weren't the best, all that stuff. But apart from that and the result, it was a really good weekend.
I was going to say, I really enjoyed watching it play out online, you know, watching your guys' sort of Twitter feeds and a few other people who, you know, we've got really strong, you know, connections with a fan cast. Todd's been a listener for donkey's years now, it feels like, and it must be kind of quite surreal when you all can't get to meet up in person.
Yeah, very much so. Right. It's like when you do have those connections, I was trying to explain it, it's like meeting up for those family weddings of cousins that you never see for like all of those years and things, but only the really nice ones, like those dickheads and stuff that you don't really like in your family. It's nothing like that. It's like getting all the cool kids back together. And there was people that I was meeting for the first time, and it just straight away that you immediately connect and start talking, and it's like you've physically known them for years, but it's only been effectively this thing that we do remotely. So it's pretty special when you factor into all of that.
I mean, the fact that I was going to say we've literally got two other people watching live at the moment, Danny Baltimore Wolves and Todd from Minnesota watching live, kind of stands testament to all of that. And you know, it's for all football can get a bad rap a lot of time, both for on the pitch stuff with VAR and off the pitch stuff. There are a few uniting forces like it, and you know, from obviously, you know, you're an expat, Paul, but you know, when we've had American fans come over and have just immediately been embraced, and like it's genuinely actually like quite cool to sort of see all these people who have traveled, you know, like, you know, Houston to Nashville is about 800 miles away. Like it's not exactly like it's nipping down the road, is it? To to go to do stuff like that, and you know, it's fun from you know, from my bit, and you know, living on social media and whatever, and like, people have met in person, like Todd, and gotten well with, and people like Danny we've had on the pod and things like that, and Josh as well, living his best life, it seemed.
That's right.
For a couple of days. But yeah, the only thing that I found curious was Matt Jarvis was out there, and like I know the one, was it in Chicago a couple of years ago now? And I was a bit upset seeing Matt Jarvis in the West Ham.
Yeah, sadly there's a there's a little story behind that, in terms of when these activations are put together, and they're looking for, well, it kind of goes twofold, is that they're looking for, really, to get coverage and NBC and everything, at least have some type of Premier League legend status about it. So obviously when likes of Newcastle, Alan Shearer always goes, and then fortunately for them, probably Jarvis was most prominent in the Premier League, even though his career was struggling with injuries. His time in West Ham was with them, so unfortunately they were able to get him, but we managed to sneak a few words with him afterwards, so that was a good feature, just to come in and meet the fans, because it is all about dollars and cents, and these folks have got to be bought over and everything. So it can be quite a logistical challenge for clubs to put this type of stuff together. So we were grateful for the support of Wolves, but obviously there's a tipping point in terms of how much they could do, if they can bring people over, combination of all the other stuff that's going on. So you have to balance those things in how much can support this little venture of 100 plus fans in Nashville. But I think just along those lines, and having representatives there from the club, I think it really went to show and reflect on social media how much of an old gold and black splash we made, because both on the Friday night, the pre-party, and then just throughout yesterday, Saturday, so many of the other fans were saying to us, I can't believe how many Wolves fans are here. And when we went to the collective and the photos, it was a genuine significant number, which is great. So I think that just taps in to show the club how much potential exists, what the fan base is over here. And when you do get these opportunities to bring people in collectively, people do buy into it. They'll travel, they'll make plans, make a weekend out of it. So it really goes to show that people will come together when it's something special.
Yeah, definitely. And like, you'd like to think that in a couple of years time, it won't be like, obviously it's like league driven, like, you know, hopefully it kind of gets to a point where it can be club driven, and you know, instead of like 30-50 Wolves fans, or you know, 100 Wolves fans being there, it will be that 3,000 mark and stuff like that, and it only kind of grows and grows. And you know, comment on YouTube, you know, saying they need to play over in over America, us, and yeah, you know, like, you can see that kind of growth and all of that. And you know, say from someone who watches American football and what they do with the NFL here, and it slowly builds up steam, you know. And some teams, obviously, like, I'm really tangenting here, and I will drag it back to actual Wolves reaction stuff, but you know, you've got people now follow Jacksonville Jaguars because they play every bloody year in Wembley, and that means they even follow them throughout the rest of the season now. And yeah, everyone wants to go and see Pat Mahomes play. Everyone wants to, you know, I say Russell Wilson a couple of years ago, because Seahawks came over quite a lot, but now it's, and I can see the same happening in America. And it's really interesting kind of seeing it play out a little bit more. And even things that say, like on social media, as a video, it kind of did rounds of people sort of doing chants and cheering and dancing. And like, actually the overwhelming response wasn't, oh, it's all naff, oh, look at these Yanks doing something differently to us. That's my Jaffo's going, oh god, Rich, please stop. But actually no, the response was genuine, like, oh, you know what, these are people wearing old gold, they're having fun, they're enjoying themselves. So you know, definitely I'm really kind of see, hopefully it kind of pans out. And you know, say, always good to sort of see our American cousins you know, say connecting, because you are dotted all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, you know, say you, Danny, and Todd, I mean, you couldn't be kind of further apart from one another geographically. And then to say to come together and, you know, I see the photos and you're just like hanging out, like you say, you've known each other for years. It's amazing. It would have probably been slightly better yesterday, I can imagine, if Bulls did manage to get 3 points or at least a point, which kind of, I guess, nicely drags us back to talking about Wolves. I mean, Jaffo, the thing that sort of stuck out, I guess, at 2pm our side was the lineup, and it had been leaked and rumoured in terms of the personnel. And when you see it on paper, Aitnori at right wing, effectively, and Doyle on the left, were you a little bit concerned, or were you very much in Gary we trust?
I mean, yeah, I always trust anything Anil wants to do, because the results that we've got this season have warranted that. But it's like, it's a double-edged sword at the moment with all the injuries that are going on. You can either trust players to play at a position who are more senior, like Aitnori, Sarabia, or play the likes of Chuamu and Frazier, who just haven't got enough minutes under their belt and are not in a position to show the qualities that they have in the right way, because of the Premier League football being so difficult for any player to come into from any league, let alone a youth player who's not played enough senior football. So, it's alarming, because we understand the situation we're in, but it's one of those you kind of have to work with the tools that you've got to try and achieve something. And as we get into it and talk more about the game, it seemed like the way that we started and set up was set in a way to work to the strengths that we had in the team. And, we had some positives to take from that.
This is an advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. We all carry different stresses, big and small. It could be from work, stuff going on at home, or just from supporting a football team you flatter to deceive, and as the bedsheets have always said, let us down. We often bottle up these stresses and try and keep a lid on them, but when you do that, it can start to affect you negatively. That's where therapy comes in. It gives you a place to get these things off your chest, get down to root cause, and figure out how to work through what's weighing you down. Therapy is there to help develop positive coping skills. It's not just for people who have experienced major trauma. It's about empowering you to be the best version of yourself. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not look and give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners can get 10% off their first month using the code betterhelp.com/wanderers. That's betterhelp.com/wanderers. Let's get back to the show. So Paul, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, it's always a bit jarring, like too strong a word, but when, you know, you see Aitnori, who does have that ability to, you know, kind of roam across the pitch, and same with sort of Doherty, to be honest, he likes to kind of pop up in unusual places. I mean, when you kind of see it in a formation like that, what was your kind of reaction when you saw it?
It was a little bit not thrown in the white towel initially, but there was a sense of disappointment in that couldn't you at least had minutes in the week? And you thought if they were building him up for anything, especially after the past two results, it would to try and get 3 points out of this one. So when he was missing, that was the big one for me, in that you just felt that we haven't necessarily got that spark. But as the first half went on, you started to tell kind of what O'Neill had got up his sleeve, and that was really starting to impact on the performance in that first half, and not just by us, in terms that we were we were still the ones taking initiative, creating chances. They only had that one early because it was a mess up from Semedo. And it seemed like it was all us. And then you started to think, oh, okay, I know what he's starting to do here, because my biggest fear wasn't necessarily our formation. It was looking at theirs and thinking they're pretty much at full strength. Like I was just petrified of Bowen running rings around us, and Kudus again from the reverse fixture. So that was playing in the back of my mind, probably more than our formation. And then as that first half went on, you kind of got an understanding of what he tried to put together, and it was working.
Yeah, I think that was the most kind of surprising thing for me, was when the game sort of started, how creative and inventive we were. And I think when you compare it to even the Burnley game, and we just didn't look at the races, and you know, we talked on the show in terms of what Leon Choromi didn't quite bring or wasn't quite trusted to do, or you know, however you measure it. But it just seemed like with those more senior players, everyone sort of knew what they were doing to do something within the game and didn't feel like they were being held back. So, you know, particularly, I could probably talk for about 20 minutes on Eight Nori. So I'll bookmark him for a second. But even players like Tommy Doyle, you know, he's not a left winger, so to speak, but he bought into what O'Neill was asking them to do. And it was kind of very clear that they were following the instructions of the manager, but also working quite a really inventive and creative framework to open up those spaces and say, whether it was Doyle or Sarabian parts from the first half as well. They really seemed on it in that first half, to a point where, you know, West Ham just completely null and void for most of that first half.
Definitely. It really started, it blunted them big time. And I think that was obviously recognised, and what probably contributed to the downfall in the second half. It was that apparent that they were struggling, that to make some changes. And even to the extent the first half, I generally can't think of any pressure that Sarr came under, really. And it wasn't like we were going chance for chance equally. It was fully in our favour. So that really, I think, was the telltale sign that something was coming. And when you make two subs at half time like they did, that was a real indication that okay, we really struggled in that first half based on what they did and how they've nullified us, and we've got to do something pretty sweeping here to switch it around.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of all, I mean, let's talk Eight Nori, because he somewhat put on a clinic in the first half. He didn't miss a pass, won all his tackles, you know, 28 of passes, dribbling shots, even winning the penalty. I mean, we could talk about whether it was soft or whatever, but I thought even just the way we came about creating it, even 38, 31 games into this league season now, like, we're still doing stuff I'm just not used to seeing Wolves players do these days, in terms of just finding themselves in that space one-on-one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain level of chaos that comes to Ryan's game, and what he needs to do in the previous couple of weeks and with this new sort of position that he's playing in is show his adaptability. And I think more minutes he's getting playing further up the field and being able to do what he does with carrying the football and, you know, and being so pressure resistant when it comes to keeping hold of the ball, that it brings those qualities to the game. And it's fantastic to see, you know, a Wolves player being so attackingly, you know, progressive and wanting to run into the box, create chances. And this is what we wanted for him. And I said it probably last reaction show, I think, where we talked about how far he's come since he's been here. And it's so refreshing to see someone who's coming as this raw left back from France who, you know, yeah, he's got good pace, he's got all the skill and all the ability, but what he needed was the conditioning. What he needed was someone to put his arm around him and say, okay, you need to slow down, look at these parts of your game and refine him as a footballer. And that's what's happened this season. And it's fantastic to see the levels that he's achieving. But as I think as Gully said last week, he's now adding goals and assists to his game. And that's dangerous because
yeah,
it puts a lot of eyes on him. And we've got a fantastic talent here. And he's worth a hell of a lot of money because there's not many players who can be as versatile in the way that he is and have, you know, playing such positions to a high standard as he's doing currently. And it's fantastic. As with everything Wolves, double-edged sword. The whole eyes of the world are watching him, and Europe's elite is going to be watching what Aitner is doing because there ain't many better fullbacks in the world at the moment, honestly. And I say that with chest.
Yeah, I think the fact that, as you say, he's so versatile, he's adding more production to his game now, because he was, you know, even when he joined, and scored on his debut, but he wasn't necessarily, he was someone who had talent, but whether he could do everything else in terms of being able to have an impact in the final third and stuff like that. But now he's having an influence on a game from a wing back position, which is just kind of unheard. Like, it's not usual in terms of how big an influence he is on the ball. And he's asked to do a job in right wing. And ultimately, I mean, I was really happy to see him because in that more progressive area of the pitch and slightly more central, because ultimately you want your best players on the ball as much as humanly possible. And I think with the personnel we had, he wouldn't get that if he was playing in effectively Doherty's position yesterday. We wouldn't be able to get the most out of him without the other players around him. So there's sort of a shift in terms of having him in that position where he's going to come inside and he's going to, you know, have more influence on the ball. I was all for it. And, you know, the worry is actually, my worry is, will he end up playing more, playing a more forward or central position going forwards, because it will suit him in terms of actually, you know what, I'm getting more time on the ball, I'm getting more space. If he's at a point where he can work on his finishing machine, like, ultimately, he's been a left back most of his life, so shooting's probably not exactly highest on his agendas. But if he can sort that out, sky is really the limit for him, isn't it?
I think that's why he was picked out for that position yesterday, because all of a sudden you saw that he could bring it in on the inside and shoot on his left, his favourite foot. So that was a really subtle tweak, I thought, in the formation to have Sarabia as that false nine and Aitner on the right. You're thinking that to start with, like, what's he doing out there? But I think that was for the intent. But the biggest one for me is like the ability he's got to progress with the ball. So if he's able to do what he can from midfield, then you just added such a different dynamism to our attacking play. So position wise, it's like when you're on Football Manager and you could have him as like left back, left wing back, left midfield, left attacker. He's just going all the way across the positions that he could take. But I've got a feeling like if this mythical 4-4-2 ever appears, wouldn't he just be phenomenal as that left midfielder? He's not a winger. He's not an attacking. He's not the front of a front three in the left. He's a genuine left midfielder and can go up and down the pitch and progress the ball. And I think that's a skill set that's in high demand and short supply, and it just goes to add to that value.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going down, you know, a hyperbole avenue here, and it's not meant to necessarily, but it's almost similar to someone like Gareth Bale in the sense that started out as a left back. I mean, even at sort of 16, 17, like, Bale was leaps and bounds beyond most, but how he kind of progressed his way, that when he was at Spurs, that he joined as a left back and slowly made himself into that more forward player, and then ultimately, you know, ended up playing effectively up front or, you know, across from three at times. So it's going to be really fascinating to sort of see how his development goes, and, you know, hopefully it's with Wolves If it's not, it's going to be a crying shame. But the penalty itself, I saw some West Ham fans saying it was soft. I don't see what was soft about it. I think he got a bit of a ball, but I think he got a lot more of a man and very much stopped Dake Norrie from progressing. Quite simple, really, weren't it?
I think the key one for me that was given on the pitch, so that in real time and that type of challenge happens anywhere else on the pitch, it's a foul. So to have it in the box, it was a Stonewall penalty for me. And then the only thing from that point is you're kind of looking over your shoulder for VAR to take a look, and then they're going to get into the weeds of, well, how much of the man was taken on the ball. But as soon as it was apparent that it was man first, then yeah, it just reinforced it.
Yeah. And when it was given and it kind of been confirmed, it had Sarabia over spot kit. And I mean, I must say, Jafot, definition of a swept home penalty. Like, of all things you can say about Sarabia, stat padder, whatever, that was a well taken pen.
A lot cooler than I thought. I was slightly concerned, to be fair, when Sarabia stepped up to take it, because I thought if there's ever like a footballer you could pick where you don't understand or don't know what to expect when it comes to something like a penalty, it would be the one in a wall shirt. If I was going to pick somebody out of that squad from yesterday to take that penalty, I'd have shoved Lamina or Doyle on it, because I just want somebody just to smash it straight down the middle, Troy Deeney starts, get it done. But, I mean, as you say, cool as a cucumber, absolutely fantastic. Found the bottom corner with ease. He styled it out like he'd been taking them all season. But he's in sort of this rich vein of form at the moment. And you can see, I know people, like you said, stat pattern and things like this, but he's growing to learn the league. And it's one of those, he's come from playing at PSG. It's not exactly the most taxing club to be at, especially when last season, the season that he was there, he had Messi with him, he had the likes of Neymar and Mbappe. He ain't under no pressure when he's at that club. He can turn up for 5-6 games a season, get the occasional goal and assist. It doesn't really matter. But to be part of the Wolves squad, every individual counts. And he proves even more so at the moment with the injuries that we're dealing with. But at any point, if we had a full squad available, every individual in this squad has got to be standing up and accounting for. And that's he's had to push himself to that level and get fitter, adapt himself to the speed and the strength that he needs for the Premier League so that he can be an effective player. And he's done that. And that's another sort of success story that we've had. And, trying to keep it positive from the results, against the results side of thing. But we can see as a football club and as a group, everyone's stepping up and everyone's pushing themselves to improve week in, week out. And it's refreshing because it shows that what's been done on the coaching side of things and on the training ground is working. And it only speaks volume of what Gary O'Neill and Sean Derry and the rest of the team that they're doing.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think you've made a really good point in terms of stepping up. And yeah, it might be from a penalty spot. And it's difficult because without our front three forwards, who takes it then? And if you're not careful, if you don't have those leaders and experienced players and those senior players who are kind of willing to step up to the plate, it then falls onto someone who might not be willing, or it might kind of go to someone like Doherty, because Doherty's the sort of person who go, oh, well, I'll take it. But actually for, let's say, Sarabia to take him, I think I'm pretty sure he scored one in the end of the season as well. I might be mistaken. Was it last season? No, I'm saying anyway.
Man United, the penalty in the home fixture. Yeah.
Yeah. But actually, I did think kind of throughout the whole game, as Dean says in the YouTube comments, he stepped up lately. He always wants the ball. He's trying to make things happen. I think he wasn't great against Burnley, but he seemed to be markedly better yesterday for me. And, Wolfpack comments from a dead ball situation, Sarabia with King. And he has got that technique to, see it through when needed. And it was a shame we couldn't just get another goal before half time, because we were so dominant, we were so on top, we were leaps and bounds better than West Ham. But then half time came, I guess, at a good time for West Ham to recalibrate. And as you said, Paul, they made two substitutions. They had the bench to do it as well, as much as anything else. And then second half, whether it was their changes or some motivational words from David Moyes, West Ham seemed like a completely different team second half.
I think it's often been derided when the speculation's been mooted, but bringing Mikel Antonio on just had me thinking, what would we do for him right now? You know, I don't care how old he is, but what he was able to do in terms of stretch the play, hold the ball up, at least give the defenders something to think about. We've got no one even close to that. So would I sign him in the summer? Like, no, because hopefully at that point in time, there's someone better out there, better strategy and everything. But every time it's been mooted, it's kind of been derided. Yet yesterday's second half performance was probably mostly injected from his input. And I think it just goes to show how significant that type of role is, how significant the leading from the front aspect is. And when we haven't had it, and then when we've had a different dynamic and those players have gone down through injury, then you are going to struggle. And that's been the case of this end towards the season, that it's coming down just to not having those profiles of player.
Yeah, it's the difference ultimately, particularly say in the second half of the game, that we managed in a way with your call, Sarabia, false nine or whatever, Son, who isn't necessarily going to stretch for play. Like West Ham tried something similar first half, didn't quite pan out, and to go to, you know, a bit of bread and butter, and to have a player who is just willing to see what he can get out of defenders, it just opens it up for everyone else sometimes. And, you know, Wolves just didn't seem to have an answer, but West Ham were just more aggressive. They were on it. They were sharper. And then the ball wasn't really kind of sticking to, you know, Wolves players either. And we had a bit of a warning sign, if we're being honest, in terms of potentially conceding, because West Ham had a goal disallowed. Defoe, was it fairly disallowed? I mean, when I kind of saw it in real time, I was a bit unsure, and I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, I didn't have many issues with the decision that, you know, straight away, I didn't think it was a goal. But it's sort of one of them, like you say, it wasn't a warning sign, because at the end of the day, the subs that were brought on did change the game, as has been said. And it sort of, the pragmatic nature of the substitutions changed the game. And the areas where they looked weakest in the first half was moving the ball up the pitch. James Ward-Prowse might as well have not played the first half, because he couldn't get forward, he couldn't progress. And by having somebody like Antonio, like we've said, and the ball sticking to him, it allows the play just to have that couple of seconds, and you get the midfielders further forward. But understanding our weak points within our squad and where our weakest area was probably left back yesterday, Matt Doherty, was that you put somebody against him who can attack him, and no nastiness towards Soufal, but he's not a modern day fullback in the sense that he can run at people and use pace, because he just hasn't got that side of his game. But Ben Johnson is more of a natural athlete, and instantly you see is where that side of the pitch was, where the ball came in from. That's where all the problems coming from straight away, because they're overloading that part of the pitch. Ben Johnson's getting high, he's causing us problems. Doherty can't get up the pitch as much. We can't progress with the ball down that side. And then obviously the chance came across Emerson. He just looked clumsy, to be fair, to go back to talking about the disallowed goal, but he looked clumsy the way he was on top of Semedo. Some people say it's lucky that the situation's, you know, the goal's been given straight away as it fell, but it's just one of those where it looked like a full-back attack in the box. He looked like a defender in that sort of situation, and at the end of the day, it was clumsy as hell.
I thought in real time that Semedo had done his Achilles or something because he went down. Mm-hmm. You thought he was in a decent position, at least to defend it, and then he just dropped. And I looked at it, I was like, shit, he's done his Achilles. And it was only playing it back that you did see the contact. And you could say that was soft and everything, but any type of scrape down the back of your leg at that point, you're going to feel it, and that it is going to take you down. So that when you do get it looked at that way, then it was a clear indication that there was a foul in there. So it was chalked off.
Yeah. I mean, I can see it being frustrating from West Ham, but I think it's very much it is. It's just annoying because I think if Emerson's a little bit smarter there, he doesn't need to make contact. He can all be a little cleverer with it, which I think is for, you know, that'd be my frustration as a, if that goal happened to Wolves. But I did bring their way back into it. Again, it was for our own mistake as much as anything else. We couldn't just, you know, clear our lines, and very sloppy play. And then Max Kilman conceding a penalty with a handball. I mean, it just seemed like a catalogue of errors, really, to concede the penalty overall.
It did. It felt like that pressure was beginning to tell, and the error that brought about in bringing the pressure back onto us in the final third, and that was the killer for me. And unfortunately, when those balls get whipped in and you're not in that position with your body to defend it in a way that you're able to clear it out the way of danger, then at any type of contact you're getting a pen called. So I think it was a case of just he was a yard slow, couldn't get his position in place, and got found out.
Yeah, and Jaffo, I feel really bad whenever it comes to a penalty, and I'm sure there's different philosophies on it. Do you think Sar should save a penalty?
It's difficult to say with penalties, because like it's essentially a free goal. As long as you don't put it in a position sort of where the goalkeeper can just naturally get to it without stretching, they're gonna, you know, you're gonna score. So the problem is why they've had to make changes with penalties is because it was probably too easy. Looking at the way that he took the penalty yesterday, I have a little bit of concern with it, with the stutter.
Yes.
Because that shouldn't be allowed. That's sort of against the rules. Stutters shouldn't really be allowed to be taken now. But, I mean, it's a good penalty again. It's found the corner. He's gone the right way. But you've got to be 6'7", 6'8", you know, almost 7 foot to dive across and reach a corner easily. So the only way you're going to do it is come off your line. And if you do that nowadays, you're going to get called back for VAR. So it's one of them. You can't.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the stutter's frustrating because he does stop his run up pretty close, like about 2 steps before the ball. I think the difference between, I guess, Sarabia's is just Sarabia's hit is a lot harder, a lot cleaner, whereas, you know, Sar goes the right way, but it just seems like it's just that bit far out of his reach. It's a well placed penalty, but what, not necessarily a well struck penalty. So, yeah. Oh, either way, you know, it's gone in. You know, of all things I can discredit Jose Sarr with, I think not being able to save a penalty just say from that, it's tricky. And, you know, say, you know, they're 9 impossible to save with the stutters. And I'm surprised it doesn't get called back because, as we know, VAR does like to, you know, make sure a goal is 100% valid. Anyway, on to the first West Ham goal, which came straight from a corner. Now, I think it's interesting because I think scoring a goal from a corner is always fun. We've had a few comments about the wind and stuff like that, and it definitely was a bit wind-assisted from Ward-Prowse. Bearing in mind how we've seen VAR being implemented, do you think this should have been reviewed a little bit in terms of Mikel Antonio's backing in on Sar, or is it really kind of clutching at straws and, you know, just a bit of savvy gamesmanship from Antonio?
I think that screen grab was particularly telling, because if Saar actually goes down with that contact with arms flailing, he's probably given, yet he still managed to try and make an attempt at saving it. So he probably didn't do himself any favours with not playing off the back of that, because if you said that that's a foul, looking at that, if he ends up on the ground, then that's the type of thing that's given. Would it be the slightest of contact? Yeah, but keepers get away with that. So in my mind, he could have, if he's going to be in that area trying to impact that space, then he's got to be trying to make the most of those opportunities that happen if he does get contact, to try and draw it. Otherwise, he should have positioned himself and stayed clear and not get involved.
Yeah, I mean, Jafar, I mean, realistically, whether Antonio's there or not, or over his contact, he's probably not getting anywhere near the ball. And Asonu coaches and manages the team. Thoughts on not having a player on the post? Because it seems to have very much gone out of fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not too bothered about not having a player, but I take massive issue with Jose Sarr's positioning. He's in the wrong area. As when you're a goalkeeper and you're defending a corner, you should be in the back half of the goal. Because if the ball comes into the near post, you've got 3-4 players there who will attack the ball before you can get there. If you have a situation where the ball's coming deep, where it has with this one, he's only got to catch it. He hasn't got to travel back to try and get to it. And that's the thing, is when you're travelling backwards, you're trying to dive backwards, your hands behind your head, you can't see where you're going. So he's totally in the wrong position. And I think Jose Sarri has made a mistake. And he hasn't got enough stick for that, and actually getting his positioning wrong, more than the fact that people say he's kicking and shit like that. Because at the end of the day, if you want to replace a goalkeeper at the level where Jose Sarri is, in the way that he's affecting the games, you have to spend a lot more money than what our transfer budget is in the summer. The thing is, with Jose Sarri, he is chaotic. He's one of these people who's going to make mistakes occasionally. And like, yes, he's made a mistake. He's in the wrong position. But would I change him for anyone else in the Premier League? Maybe, yeah. But you'd have to go for one of the elite goalkeepers, or you'd have to spend £40-50 million. And that's our old transfer budget gone on a position that we don't need to change.
It's a classic case of you get what you pay for. So, and is he proving that worth? He is. And there's some highlights. There's going to be some clangers. But you're dead on that. If you're going to upgrade, then you're talking big bucks, and for that team, do we need to? I'm not convinced.
No, I think I'm very sort of similar in terms of his overall place in this team. Unless we can like really find a amazing goalkeeper from obscurity, and realistically, I think the floor and the ceiling in terms of goalkeepers is actually relatively tight. Like, it's, as you said, Chifford, like, you've got a couple of goalies in the league who are at the top of their game, and they play for, you know, the big six. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I think a lot of the goalies are in that middle ground. I don't think it's as defined as, let's say, a new centre-half. I think that's the difference. And yeah, maybe we improve the goalkeeper once we've got some of those other positions nailed down and sorted a little bit more. Because it is frustrating. And, you know, West Ham, I haven't kind of read much in terms of the corner because of the VAR stuff, which we'll talk about in a sec. But I'd be curious in terms of how much is, you know, Ward-Prowse maybe doing his homework as well, because, you know, they do, you know, they analyse these things to the nth degree. And I'm not saying Ward-Prowse necessarily meant to score from a corner, but actually, you know, to put it in a really dangerous area, you look at how they're set up. It's tricky, isn't it? And it's frustrating because it should be preventable. We've got Paul Hale on YouTube comments saying, you know, we shouldn't be scoring off a corner. And I get it. And, I, you know, definitely the elements didn't help, but we didn't, again, same with first goal, we just didn't help ourselves. We didn't make it hard for them. You know, Dean in the comments saying, you know, we had everyone back. There's no reason we shouldn't be protecting those areas. Or, as you said, Jafo, enabling Saar to cover that half of his goal as well. I mean, when I saw it was 2-1 and Kuna was already on and he looks completely shot of it. Son, who just did not look at all up to match tempo. And if, you know, looking back to, you know, the last 15 minutes or so against Burnley, he didn't look awful, but he really looks poor for match fitness yesterday. And when we can see the second, I thought, oh, we've got no chance here. Like, you know, might as well just wrap it up. It's Wolves. And, you know, we end up getting a corner in the final minutes. And Max Kilman, out of nowhere, and just crashes home a header. And I'll be honest, my immediate reaction was, I feel he should be celebrating more. He didn't look particularly... He looked like he scored like the consolation in like a 5-1 defeat. Not, oh, I've just got a last-minute equaliser. And I know, like, probably to be fair, from what I've seen of Max Kilman, it probably, as a scoring a consolation goal, scoring a 90th-minute winner, his emotion levels probably don't differ too much. But, I mean, that was my initial reaction.
It was like they were 3-1 down, went to 3-2 and yeah, were still trying to get the equaliser. And I was thinking, man, they've equalised. Given our MO, they've equalised too early. There was still time to throw it away. That was my biggest fear. I was like, celebrate a bit more, suck it up. Don't go charging back to restart the game. Let's kill some time.
And I guess Defoe, went Pete Tong. Because about 30 seconds later, it pops up. It's being analysed for an offside. And a term, I'll be honest, I hadn't heard before, was a subjective offside. As you do, really. I mean, nuts and bolts of it. Do we think Fabianski... I've pulled up a image for anyone who's listening. You know, there's an image sort of doing rounds in terms of what is Fabianski's perspective on it. Do you think the positioning's really impacting Fabianski that much?
In a word, no. Not at all. I think Fabianski is very, very lucky because at the end of the day, the ball has gone to his side. He's never saving it. A bullet header from that distance out, when it's gone down to the side of the goalkeeper, as long as it doesn't go at the goalkeeper, he's not expected to save it. And I take the biggest problem I have with what has come out of it is the word subjective, because subjective means an opinion. If it isn't black and white, then how can it rule over the game? Because somebody can look at it from VAR and a different referee the next week could have a different opinion and have the different outcome. And that's kind of what VAR is being brought in to try and stop. It's just wrong because it is, you know, I don't want to say absolute bollocks, but it's because somebody says in the comments it is absolute bollocks. And it's stupid because at the end of the day, VAR is brought in to be black and white. That's why it's brought in for offsides, because offside, you either offside or not. That's what the lines are there for. No matter how annoyed people are with it, it's there. You know, it's a binary, it's one or zero when it comes to a decision. But when it comes to the subjective nature of a decision and somebody can have an opinion on it and somebody say, oh, well, I think he has and I think he hasn't, then it's not really clear and obvious. So you go with the decision on the pitch. And if the flag went up, then it's offside. If the flag doesn't go up, then it's not offside. That's it, end of story. You can't have re-refereeing on an opinion as an opinion because it doesn't make sense. It does not make any sense at all. And it's VAR being used wrong.
Yeah, I think you've summed it up perfectly in terms of that subjectivity of it. And I was trying to work out, if the line had flagged it as offside, what would my reaction be? I think I'd be frustrated, but I'd get it because the linesman, from his perspective, you know, sideline on, can see, that Trier's offside. He is offside. Like, there's no two ways about it. He's behind the last defender. But as you said, Defoe, if a ref's kind of thought, you know what? No, nothing. The linesman's gone. No, not seen it. And it doesn't exactly happen often, because usually you say there's someone on the post, there's someone on the line, there's players back there, there's players protecting the ref, and sort of no one, you know, picked up him a couple yards out. So it's very rare, you have a player in that situation, but he's 5 yards out. The reaction of him to be able to do it, it's just, it doesn't line up. You know, the whole interfering with an opponent, which is what it's classed as, because it's not, Twan does not play the ball or anything. So he's interfering with the opponent, means preventing an opponent from playing or being able to play the ball by clearly obstructing the opponent's line of vision or challenging an opponent for the ball. And ultimately, I don't really think he's done that. But if it was flagged off the side, I'd get it. In terms of what you said, Jeffo, whereas this whole, you know what, let's go back. Because I've got a different opinion to what you did. It's just grating, isn't it?
Even that terminology, clearly obstructing, says there can be some type of instruction. So if Torreira is covering his left eye and he can still see through the right, then he's obstructed it. He's not clearly obstructed it. So it's just a whole convoluted mess, really, in terms of that whole description has been mentioned, that the subjectivity beyond it, if you're looking for those types of things, it just feels to me like it's every opportunity with those types of decisions to rule a goal out, and ruling a goal out is the complete opposite of why we all go to football in the first place. So it just makes zero sense.
Yeah, and I still feel my reaction would be the same if that incident happened in the 41st minute. And I think it's quite hard in a debate when it comes about football. And like, I was looking at, you know, all the times VAR has haunted Wolves this season. You know, it's been pretty consistent. Although we've done well since the start of the year, we've not had to mention it at all, really. But obviously, you know, we had in the last minute against Man United, first game of the season. We've had ones against Luton, Newcastle, Fulham, you know, and now this one. I just, yeah, very kind of good YouTube comment again from Still With Me. Simply can't let Mikel Antonio off the approach impacted for goal and not let Chirea, off when he had no impact whatsoever. You let one instant go, but not the other. And I'm sure if you viewed every corner, you'd see four or five different types of infringements. But then at that point, just let it be up to the referee's discretion. Let it be that, Eddie Fong, 100% subject to offside by its definition of flexibility as to when not an offside applies, i.e. Don't believe your eyes, recorded factual evidence, the opinion of one man will decide. And let that one man be the bloke on the pitch, ultimately. I guess if the shoe's on the other foot, how would you feel if, you know, Wolves conceded that goal and it wasn't flagged up? I don't know. I still think you'd look at, I'd like to think I'd still look at the evidence and see it and go, well, actually, you know what? Nothing's really, actually, to be fair, we've been fairly balanced, because even for the Jose Sarr corner one, we've kind of gone, well, there is a bit of contact. He probably could and should have made more of it, but ultimately he's nowhere near it and he's not got himself right. And, you know, if I was a West Ham fan and that went in, my worry wouldn't be, oh, you know, that Wolves subs offside. It's who the fuck isn't marking that 6'2" centre half 5 yards out? Like, you watch it in real time and Max Kilman has the run of the penalty box. So I don't even think, I'm genuinely fascinated to see how many situations you get where you have a you know, you have a forward who's effectively offside from plays like that, because I think it would happen more often than you think. But it's interesting, and you know, as I mentioned, we've had a number of instances this season and the last couple of seasons and things like that, and there does seem to be like genuine like growing disconcern for fans and people going to the games, and you know, whether it's all in the moment, but the amount of people I've seen who have gone, I don't really care about the end of the season now, I don't even know if I want to watch it next season, which is probably a little bit, you know, dramatic. But something's got to be done just to make the lives easier for the people watching it, and albeit the people officiating it, because it ain't right. It's not working, ultimately.
Just as way those reactions go, we do need to say a little prayer for our friend Todd DeWitt, because imagine us all watching collectively in front of this big screen alongside West Ham fans, who was our fan to run straight in front of him, give it the big one. It was Todd. And then for have that to come back, they celebrated that reversal of a decision louder than either of the two goals. And that was purely down to what Todd did. But again, that just goes that the whole thing is you're taking that passion, you're taking that instant joy out of it. So I felt very much the same, like just that general malaise. Like, oh, here we go again. You know, we got shafted. Great. Like, it's the Wolves. It's typical. And if that keeps on happening, you are generally going to turn people away from the game, turn people away from supporting that club, because it just starts to become, just give evidence to there's that agenda going on, and it's always us. And if that's the case, like, what's the point when the odds are permanently stacked against us? So,
yeah. I mean, we've had a couple of comments coming in. You know, we still have three home games in a week coming up, still alive. And I guess that's a nice point to wrap up the show, because, you know, if to make sure people who are Werewolves are currently 11th. And I guess we are looking that little bit more behind us than in front of us now, to a degree. I mean, the gap between 13th and 14th is about 9 points. So we're pretty much going to finish it in the top, you know, the lowest we can finish is 13th, really. West Ham, fortunately, have kind of just crept away from us that bit more, considering at one point we'd leapfrogged them in the table at the end of the first half, and now all of a sudden six clear with us, where we've got seven to go, they've got six. It'll be hard for us to kind of catch up West Ham now, which is really frustrating. But you know, we've still got an opportunity of that top half finish, and you know, when you look at the games coming up in terms of those sort of three home games, we've got Forest away next weekend. Then we've got, you know, a couple of really interesting games in terms of Bournemouth midweek. We've got Arsenal at home as well, and Luton, before ending, you know, the season with Man City, Palace and Liverpool. I mean, ultimately, there's probably like four games there that we'd hopefully be getting. You know, if we're somehow able to get, you know, four wins out of those last seven, and then lose the three inevitably to, you know, the likes of Man City, Arsenal, Liverpool, that puts us in a half decent position to end the season, you know, to get 12 more points and hopefully finish on, you know, 54 points. I mean, that's far, far greater return than what I was expecting from this season.
Yeah. I think you're probably not far off. I think 50 is probably a good number to go for. I think that's sort of, like you say, it's not what we expected at the start of the season. You know, we expected to struggle. Granted, we probably should have done better than we have, given the way that the season's gone. But you can't allow for what's happened with the injuries and the way that it's been set up in terms of where the club is. You know, we went through it a lot last week on the Reaction Podcast about what the club could have done, what Gary O'Neill could have done. But at the end of the day, you have to say the players have achieved above what we expected, and to get to where we are, to get to 40 points as early as we did in the season, you know, hats off to the job that was done in essentially a few days. before the Man United game at the start of the season, and it's been done throughout the campaign so far.
For me, I think it's showing that I think on the balance of the season, we're probably going to finish the top of the bottom, and it's going to even out that we'll be above the likes of Brighton and Palace and all those middle of the table teams. The only ones we'll be behind that really we should be on a level playing field will be the likes of West Ham and Newcastle and Villa, who have jumped ahead. I think we could well be comfortably the top of all of the rest. Out of those games against Arsenal, Man City and Liverpool, we'll probably win one of them based on what we've done this season. I can't tell you which one. It feels like we do a result at home against Arsenal for once. It could be that. So there's 3 points there. And then if they do, I'm always quite confident at the moment of going away from home. So I'm looking quite positively against Forest that there's some potential there. So if they did that win, got something against Forest, and then do the business against the teams that they're expected to do at home, then there might be that slight chance. But I do think that the ship sailed, and what we'll be looking for is that real, you know, top of the bottom team, that genuine mid-table side.
Yeah, I think the dream of getting into Europe's slot, I think, might be a stretch too far. I think if we are able to finish 10th, that is a phenomenal season. So we've had on comments, every place we finish above 17th is a budget win. So that's nice. But, you know, considering we were tipped for relegation at the start of the season and in pre-season, even if we finish 13th and it's a bit of a damp squid, that we can, at least we've had some really exciting football, some entertaining games and things like that. And there's definitely building blocks to move forward with, hopefully, going into next season as well. But we'll wrap it up there. We will be back probably Thursday to preview the Forest game, which is always a tasty affair. I'm really looking forward to that game, actually, because it's a really fun, good rivalry there. Between Wolves and Forest. So yeah, we'll be previewing that game and also doing a review show of it as well. If you haven't already, make sure you like, share and subscribe to the YouTube channel, to the video, to the pod, but any Fancast content, please and thank you. And if you don't know where to find this wonderful content, we're at Wolves Fancast here, there and everywhere, your Twitters, your Facebook, your Instagrams, your YouTubes. So make sure you're following us as well. Until next time, and big thank you to Paul for coming on today's show.
Thanks, everyone.
Cheers, and it's goodbye from Chifo.
See you all.
And it's goodbye from me. Have a great week, and see you next time.